Hi, you've reached the High Fashion Hotline.
Hi, my family's going to a tailgate, and I want our style to stand out from the crowd.
Just go to Old Navy.
Old Navy?
Yep, Old Navy's got all the latest fall styles. Plus, during Old Navy's colossal sale, you'll save up to 50% off store-wide.
Did you say up to 50% off?
I did, so don't sit on the sidelines. Old Navy has the perfect pants from $19, stylish dresses from $15, and comfy tees for the family from just $6 right now at Old Navy and OldNavy.com.
We're cheering for Old Navy.
High Fashion, Old Navy. Valid 10-2 to 10-10. Select styles only.
Blog Talk Radio.
Do you think you know what the government should do? Then this show is for you. We're not looking for the Mercury extremes, but rather the 72 and sunny, rational-minded intellects and craftsmen who can weave an effective dialogue of government that doesn't pit poor against rich, middle class against elite, self-entitled versus shutter-outers of the American dream. Are you a middle-class, tax-paying American who still has it good after the last 3 years? Do you think the government can succeed with or without a religious consensus? Are all media outlets just full of crap? Be on the show to be counted as the voice of reason in turbulent times. Who's the bad guy? Let's find out. This is Political Gravity with your host, Jane Hoffman.
You, Jane, to go live in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everybody. This is Jane Hoffman with Political Gravity. And tonight we're doing a tribute show. We're tributing Lorenzo or Larry Rosbaugh. And he's from the Oblates of a Mary Immaculate priesthood. I'm going to be reading a letter that he sent me in 1991 about his life, and it starts off at the very inception of him wanting to become a priest. Now, I know we have listeners from the Milwaukee and Chicago area, and I'm hoping you'll call in later in the show. But I'm going to spend the first part of the show outlaying his life, because he was a well-known priest that suffered for humankind on all levels. He went to prison at least 3 times, once in Texas for nuclear protests, once in Milwaukee for the Vietnam War, once in Brazil. And you'll hear about all these escapades that Larry went on to try to protect what he felt like was the fringes of our society that were victimized. He saw the wars in Central America firsthand, and he was played a very active role in Guatemala and El Salvador after Osco Romero was assassinated. And I'm here to tell you about his life. I also want to mention that the chat room is open. So for those who are computer savvy, if you click on www.blogtalkradio.com/ErnestRadioNetwork, you'll be able to chat in the room and perhaps bring up facts about Larry I may not even know. So up until the end of his life, Father Lawrence Rosbaugh was serving the poor, and I just want to go over a couple of skeletal facts. He was an Oblate parish priest with a missionary priest with a long history of taking risks to aid the poor and the marginalized, and he was killed in Guatemala May 18, 2009. There was a funeral for him in Guatemala on May 20th at St. Cecilia Parish in the suburb of Guatemala City, and the Father Vincent Luwagi was presiding. He said that in the sermon that Father Rosbaugh was a mix between St. John the Baptist and St. Francis of Assisi, from his smile, his eyes, to his unforgettable flowing white beard. He had eyes that shine when he spoke of children and of God, Father Luwagi said. And up until this point, as well as I can find on the internet, his murder by carjacking has never been solved. Let's back up now and start with the letter, and then I would like to hear from callers later in the show. Okay? I was a priest in March 1963 in Pine Hills, Mississippi, some 60 miles from New Orleans, Louisiana. I belonged to a missionary order founded by Bishop Eugene de Mazernod in France in 1826 called Oblates of Mary Immaculate. It was a coincidence that landed me in the seminary in this particular congregation. At 18, a friend of mine and I decided to leave our homes in St. Louis. I visited an uncle of mine in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. We hitchhiked, a first for both of us. My Uncle John had moved to Texas, and he was sort of a nomad type, although he was a realtor and quite well off. His wife couldn't see living out with the cactuses and the horses John loved to raise, and she left with their three daughters. Charlie, my friend, and I decided to visit Uncle John, his ranch and horses, out in the cactus and the rattlesnake country. Our time there with John has been engraven in my memory ever since. John literally lived alone 10 or 15 miles from his neighbors, his horses and himself. Our small brick ranch house full of dust, the bare necessities and furniture and utilities, horse gear and feed and a shotgun. We are having some fuzziness, Ernest, on the show. I might have to close out the chat room, okay? Okay, anyways, I'm going back to the story now. He didn't intend for our visit to be a picnic. He woke us up at 6 a.m. to do chores to his yippee-yi-yo yodels and sent into us doing chores like feeding horses, building projects with the Mexican labor. I question to this day what he paid the workers. It was on one of those early morning trips that he drove us to a spot located at the Rio Grande River, and it was there we met Friar Jim Smith Oblate of Mary Immaculate, the Oblate of Mary Immaculate. He was there in his cut-off Levi shorts, pot belly, and from the moment I knew we had met a real character, he too gave us orders to clean the cabin, catch crabs in the river for dinner, and in general not to be the butt of John's and his remarks, which meant teenagers nowadays are soft. They've never worked a day in their life. But there was always something we liked about this priest in his cowboy boots and cut-off Levi's. On Sunday afternoon, more men gathered there at the cabin and played cards and drank beer. One Sunday afternoon, many men gathered and they ate the crabs from the river where we caught them. Friar Smith gave us a tour of the Rio Grande Valley and the parishes he had worked over the past 30 years, all by horseback. It was obvious he loved the Mexican people, and they loved him by their exchange. You could see it in their eyes. After 2 or 3 weeks in the valley with Uncle John and Jim Smith, we were filled with stories and adventures in our time, and we brought those stories back to St. Louis. Uncle, it was one of those early morning trips above that he drove us to a spot located in the Rio Grande River. It was there that he taught us about the church and what it meant to him. On leaving, Jim Smith said, "You guys, if you ever want to do something useful with your life, like becoming priests, you know where to reach me." About 2 years later, after quitting college and working on a construction crew, his words read through my mind, and before I knew it, I was writing him. It was around Christmas time, 1955, in January or February. I was sitting at the desk in an Oblate seminary close to St. Louis, but on the Illinois side of the river. I had grown up loving sports and dreaming of being a big league baseball player. I love contact sports and outdoor sports, and I guess that's why Jim Smith appealed to me, because he was on horseback and he approached all his ministries on horseback. What I do see all these things in the light of faith, meeting Friar Smith, joining a missionary order, all sum up quite providential. Our major seminary, though, we were students of the Central Province, which was located on the Mississippi on the Gulf of Mexico. I became a priest, and our backyard was the Gulf of Mexico. The order had brought in a hotel that had sat idle for over 15 years, and the last group of students spent over 2 years renovating this huge five-story building. We soaked in the surroundings there in Mississippi. Poor blacks and whites lived in shanties in the woods close by. In the years that we got to know our neighbors, we got a first-hand look at the racial friction and hate cast upon our black friends. I slowly began to question why. Our order invited other congregations and religious groups. Ernest, am I still on the air? Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Well, you're fine. I know there was a little buzzing earlier, but you're okay, so just continue on.
Okay. Our order invited other congregations and religious groups to use our premises for retreats on the weekends, the summer months. One such order, the Josephites out of New Orleans, came regularly each year to take advantage of the beautiful surroundings and peaceful atmosphere of the seminary. Amongst the priests of this new group of Josephites was a young, handsome, athletic-looking man by the name of Philip Berrigan. This was in the early 60s. By this time, the Second Vatican Council of John the 23rd was opening the windows of the church. Our professors in the seminary were mostly educated in Rome before the council, and talk of change and reading the Catholic Worker and discussing the ideas within were highly dangerous paths to be walking. Just to cue everybody in, the Catholic Worker was a group started by Dorothy Day, and she started the soup kitchens in America, and they also did labor resistance with the unions when the country was in the major labor disputes. I'm going to read a couple more pages, and then I'm going to do a soundbite of Larry's letter to Dorothy Day. So Philip Berrigan's presence was like fresh air to most of us who met him. He showed what he knew of the Catholic Worker philosophy and his acquaintance with Dorothy Day. He encourages us to read and write well so we could press our ideas and share them with others. The day came when we heard we had been detained in Jackson, Mississippi on a way to a luncheon counter sit-in at a restaurant in Jackson. Phil Berrigan had been detained, that is, because he was doing protests with the black community. His religious superior sent word by Greyhound to return immediately to New Orleans or risk possible suspension from the Josephites. He obeyed and he returned. On a few more occasions, some of the seminarians sneaked over to the Josephite High School, went on trips to New Orleans. I still remember those visits with Phil. Out came the books on his bed sharing what was going around the world, the need for religious people to get involved in the struggle with the poor. Phil spoke of his Jesuit brother Daniel, who happened to be his brother, that he was an artist, writer, but above all worked with young students to get them interested in the world around them. From Jim Smith, from the Oblate Immaculate in the Valley, and Phil Berrigan, Dorothy Day, who came to spend some days at our seminary, to a very reluctant staff who kept Dorothy Day out of reach, except the time that she spoke to us, I was influenced by these people. It was the coincidence of persons and happenings in my life that gradually began to have an effect on me. With the seminary, we had some fine guys who helped each other in our thinking, and we encouraged each other to put our ideas into practice. It's important to mention, too, my mom and dad. They were two people who lived out their Christian lives better than anyone I've ever known. My dad often said he would be content if there was always food for the family on the table. He wasn't taken up with buying a new car or owning a new home or the latest modern gadgets. The church, the daily mass, the family rosary were the most important things to my mother and father. Solutions to all problems were sought through prayer, through fasting, and much sacrifice on their part. These simple essentials in life have to this day been the most important elements throughout all my years. Ordained in 1963, I had requested, as we were required to do, to write three locations of preference where we would like to work. We're coming up to the civil disobedience part, so everybody stay tuned. I wrote my preferences: Brazil, the Philippines, and Vietnam. All three requests were turned down. Our ordination class had too many far-out ideas, and they kept us in the U.S. for a few years where our lives could be supervisors and guided until we matured. They caught on to their radical behavior. Those were trying years after ordination, yet being free of the seminary allowed more contact with what was going on. Social action groups were in the Young Christian Workers Movement, the Catholic Worker Movement, and the Worker Priests, etc. It took me just 9 months to be removed from my first assignment. It was an Oblate parish in St. Paul, Minnesota, under a Polish pastor who was to help in my spiritual formation. To bed by 10 p.m., teach grades up to the fifth grade because young girls older than 13 or 14 could be a temptation to the newly ordained. That was the opinion of the Polish pastor. But people of social conscience sprang up all around me in the parish, in the youth groups, and the young Christian workers outside the parish. Go to the worker. Don't sit down. Go to him. Don't wait for them to come to you. Frequent the bars. Listen to what's happening out there. That was the call of the Catholic priest. Often I found myself being locked out of the rectory at night, and I had to sleep in the school where I taught because I was locked out and I could no longer go within the rectory. The Vietnam War was at its peak, and so was the civil rights movement. When I found myself transferred, I was transferred to a parish in Duluth, Minnesota, to track religion in the Catholic high schools. There it was with these interests and background that I came. Without textbooks for religion in those days, no experience at teaching, it was tough. Parents complained about our criticizing the government's position on the Vietnam War to the students in the classroom, speaking concretely about racism, and racism right within the city of Duluth. But we survived 3 years in Duluth with a lot of good experiences behind us. We had organized a group of students to go to Mississippi on their Christmas vacation to do voter registration among the black community. The students stayed with poor black families, ate in black restaurants, and even joined a black picket line demanding that blacks be hired. The group of six were arrested for their protests, and at one point, as we walked slowly with our picket signs, a car full of Klan members drove at us at full speed while the Meridian, Mississippi police looked on. I'm cutting to Ernest Soundbite now, and we'll continue with the letter after that. Thank you. Ernest?
Yes. Where are we going, Jane?
We're cutting to your first soundbite.
For the letter, for Larry's letter?
Yes.
Okay.
Dear Dorothy and friends, I've begun letters to you several times during my stay in Recife. After each beginning, I felt a certain incompleteness about the thoughts I wished to convey, and so the pages remain unfinished and collecting dust. However, since May, things have taken on a different appearance, helping me to put some clarity to my overall vision. On that day, my friend Tom, an American working with the Mennonites in Recife, and I were apprehended by the police as we wheeled our cart to the market for vegetables. As a result of the plea from Dom Helder Camara, Tom and I had come to the decision to live and work on the city streets. A man eating red clay sprinkled with salt had appeared one night on the doorstep of Dom Helder, who found him the next day limp and dying. For Tom and myself, such a call to respond to the forsaken of the street seemed providential, flowing naturally from the course of our past lives. We talked for many hours exploring the different possibilities. We thought, we prayed, we talked with Dom Helder and others who experienced in Recife far surpassed our own, until we reached the point, after weeks, where there was nothing more to do but to begin.
From Duluth to Chicago, with the okay from my provincial bishop to work in the inner city, planning another Oblate, how we felt was the best direction. We wanted to take action, but when official permission from the Cardinal Lodi was requested, the response was no. Chicago didn't need any more religious orders involved in the inner city work. It was shortly after this, in the summer of 1968, I was given permission to go to Milwaukee to work in the Casa Maria Catholic Worker House. I felt content. I spent May, June, July of this year with Carl Meyer and his wife and two children in a Catholic worker house in Chicago for men who had lived on the streets of Chicago. That story would be a book, but Carl and Jean made a deep impression on me. The men drank and quarreled, and often fights broke out in the middle of the night. Carl and his philosophy of nonviolence put to practice won quite an influence on me. On Friday nights, men from the Catholic worker house and Carl would literally speak from homemade soapboxes on the streets of Chicago, raising questions of the Vietnam War, racism, poverty, the rights of the farm worker, and others. Milwaukee, the Catholic worker, Casa Maria, Mike and Nettie Cullen and their two children at the time had put this house together just with volunteer and prayers. This was the early part of August 68, as I recall. My first impression of the Casa Maria was a good one. The house filled with Native Americans, blacks, and poor whites. There was always a flux of volunteers coming in and out. Some came as far away as countries from Europe to help out for the summer. 3 weeks after my arrival, there was an announcement that Dan Berrigan would be speaking at the college and that anyone from CASA could go. We piled into a car and went. Dan sat on a small stool and delivered his talk. I was moved. He then invited any and all the clergy attending to meet us in one of the classrooms. It was there that each of us present shared our concerns about the Vietnam War and what we had been doing to work to end it. Dan then invited any of us to come to a retreat in New Jersey to further discuss what actions could possibly follow. My first reaction was, it's impossible for me to think about action when only being in Milwaukee a short time. It seems the evening came and go, and I decided to leave for New Jersey from one last beckoning. I jumped in the car and left. It was a two-day, possibly three-day retreat, a weekend, I recall. There must have been about 40 people in all. A very reflective and intense time. Dan was reflecting with us on passages of Isaiah, and we got into the reality of the war promptly. Our concerns about our past experiences and present interests, it was a group of young and old, sisters and priests and laymen. I didn't take long to discern that some action was necessary. How could we best express ourselves? Catonsville had taken place already in May and had a strong impact. It made sense. Destruction of Class A files of those most apt to be drafted soon. Who was able to act? Who could support these actions? And so we met in two groups. The closing days, we were ready to act and able to support in some way. I found myself in the room of those saying that they would act. How did I get here so quickly, never thinking that this might be part of my life? The night before, I was having a battle within myself. I was convinced I didn't know enough about what the war was, although it appeared an atrocity to me. I questioned my motives. I must do something after years of explaining to students the sin of this war and how they in conscience must apply for conscientious objector status. But still, I sought out Dan and went for a walk with him. It comes down to this. He finally told me, do I believe the words of the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill? And if so, what am I going to do about it? The millions already dead, the innocent women and children in small Vietnamese villages by U.S. bombs and invasions. As a Christian, as a clergy, could I sit any longer with my arms crossed? And so the decision was made, and I slept well, I guess. Basil O'Leary and I were pushed out to enter the federal building in clerical garb. We were to pose as priests. The retreat group thought we were the compassionate type who would least upset the cleaning ladies on duty. But the amazing thing is, to this day, is that we decided so much in those days together. Who would be responsible for what? Preparations, the city and the date, and all that went with it. I doubt if any of us had any sense as to what it would cost us in energy, pain to family, pain of separations from spouses and loved ones, the prison experience itself. But perhaps grace works in the present moment. For the present moment, the future will unfold at any moment. I'm now going to play a clip prepared by Father Rosebaugh's words to Dorothy Day. The letter will be spoken in five parts, and then we're going to break. Thank you for listening to the first part of the letter. I'll finish off with his actions and more from Fort Benning, Georgia, where he protested the El Salvadorians training to kill their own people. Back with you soon.
This is Political Gravity with Jane Hoffman on ERN, Earnest Radio Network. ERN, Earnest Radio Network.
This broadcast will continue right after this brief message.
Hey everybody, it's Ernest Sewell, founder of the Ernest Radio Network. If you haven't been listening to ERN, here's some of the things you've been missing.
In the past few days, I've been, for some reason, reading about Rosa Parks, and I realized when the incident happened on the bus, she was 42 years old when it happened. I'm 42 years old, and I only hope that if I'm ever faced with a similar thought, that I can make the same brave decision. And I think a lot of young people these days don't get involved because they haven't been taught that.
You're right, and I'm glad you brought it out. But I have to say to you, Ernest, you are making a difference, and you're taking advantage of a platform in regards to BTR to do that. I have to tell you that you have brought a broader understanding across BTR, and I'm not making this up. I can go get people that will tell you this. You brought a broader understanding all across BTR in regards to the gay community, the issues that gay people face, that the gay community face, and I think it's just absolute great work that you do. But I don't want people to think that you are just exclusive to that cause, because you also bring up a lot of other issues and you explore them too. Racism, I've heard you elaborate on that, you know, and deliver it just as well as I could or better. Women's rights. You have taken this platform and your shows, and you are making that difference at 42. So keep doing what you're doing.
What's up? I cannot keep quiet about Will Ferrell. Will Ferrell ruins everything. He ruined Land of the Lost. He ruined Bewitched. He ruined half of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I don't trust anything ever come out. I thought I'd give him one more chance, and he blew it. Yeah, but yeah, you're saying, Jeremy, if you're saying that Megamind's just another Will Ferrell movie,
but it's a kid's version of a Will Ferrell movie. That's it.
Is there anything else you'd like to share?
Can I share a short story, or have you got enough time?
Yes, we would love to have you do that.
A short story?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay,
we would love to have you do that.
It's a very short story. It has to do with, it's a story that was done by Marie Snowden, and it comes actually from World War I. What the story is about, the American soldiers are in France fighting during World War I. They die, their sergeant is killed, or they're very close to him, and they take him to a Catholic cemetery and a Catholic church, and they want to bury their sergeant there because he's such an important person to their lives. But the priest says, no, you can't, because only Catholics can be buried in this cemetery. So they bury him just outside the fence, and they go back to the battle. About a month and a half later, they come back to lay flowers on the grave and to remember the sergeant. And when they get there, they can't find the grave. And
wow.
They can't find it. So what happens is they go to the priest and say, what happened? And the priest said, I was moved by your love for your sergeant and your wanting to respect him. And so I moved the fence.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody, this is Ernest, the head of the Ernest Radio Network. I just wanted to take a minute out of this show to thank you for listening to this show and any show on the Ernest Radio Network. Whether it's my show, Chris's Untitled Geek Show, or Political Gravity with Jane Hoffman, we work hard to bring you good conversations, thought-provoking shows, and just great entertainment. Right on our Blog Talk Radio page, you can find links to Chris's Untitled Geek Show blog and Twitter, Political Gravity with Jane Hoffman, and the Ernest Experience Radio Show. Or just keep in touch with our Blog Talk Radio page. Remember, you can find the Ernest Experience Radio Show right here every Thursday night at 9 o'clock Eastern, 8 Central. You can find Political Gravity with Jane Hoffman on every other Sunday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. And you can find Chris's Untitled Geek Show right here, 9 p.m. Eastern, every Wednesday evening. We want to hear from you. Let us know what you want to hear on the show. Go click the like button on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. There's a lot of awesome things we have coming up, and we don't want you to miss it. So thank you for listening, and let's get back to the show.
ERN, Ernest Radio Network.
That was Macy Gray singing Money. It's a free track. You can get it at macygray.com. She's giving out free music every Wednesday. I have a couple of callers on the line, and I'm gonna corral them in a minute. And I still have more of the letter to read, but I'm going to finish that off at the end of the show. So, Ernest, one of my friends has prepared a few audio letters, you know, that were Larry Rosbaugh's own words. He had written them to Dorothy Day during a couple of his actions in Central America, and he may play them now.
For life on the streets, this meant putting ourselves in the midst of the reality of the streets. It meant going to the city with few belongings on our backs to search for some place to lay our heads. We discovered such a place close to the open market. There the poor came to beg in front of the huge church by day and to sleep on the steps at night. The nights were damp and the concrete a bit hard at first. We tossed and twisted and curled up for protection as the winds and occasional rains blew around us. We quickly learned the tricks of survival. Cardboard for a mattress, plastic for bedding, one's personal belongings for a pillow. Our sleeping neighbors were different men and women. Maria, her leg in a knee-high cast and smoking her pipe, preferred sleeping on the streets, close to her friends, to staying in her baraka, a house of clay or wooden boards where stagnant water, rats, roaches, and threats of floods are ever present. Here in the streets, at 65, begging during the light hours is to buy a plate of hot beans and rice. She has companions to pass the day. Around 7 o'clock each evening, Tom and I would gather the leftover vegetables from the streets. Tomatoes, sweet potatoes, carrots, onions, and whatever we could find, and place them in a large pot in which we boiled our soup. The plaza in the middle of the marketplace is a natural place for an open fire. Even as we began to prepare the vegetables, the kids abandoned to the streets. Women would make their daily bread as prostitutes. Men and women, down and out and just plain hungry, all awaited the soup to simmer.
That was an excerpt of Larry's letter to Dorothy Day that took place on the streets of Brazil, and it was provided by Mary Lou Peterson from Chicago. I will now take a caller if anyone's available to speak about his life. Are there any callers, Ernest, or
yes.
Should I go back to... Hello?
Hello.
Hi, who am I speaking with?
I guess you're talking to Carl Meyer from Nashville, Greenlands, a Catholic worker community in Nashville, Tennessee, a friend of Larry Rosbaugh way back to 1968, 42 years ago, shortly before he...
Well, that's awesome. Did you know him in Milwaukee?
Before Milwaukee.
Did you
serve
with him?
I had a little Catholic worker shelter in Chicago. And I met Larry in the summer of 1968 or the spring of 1968 when Father Joe Mulligan, a Jesuit, not at that time a priest yet, and I were going around to Catholic parishes to talk about the war in Vietnam. And we had one meeting, there were only two people who came to the meeting in this parish church. One of them was Larry Rosebaugh, at that time in Roman collar, and a friend that he brought with him from the St. Benedict's High School, where he was then teaching, and to this discussion on Vietnam. And then that summer, he came and took care of my house of hospitality in the slums near Cabrini Green Homes in Chicago, right after the riots in which part of our neighborhood was burned down and there was gunfire in our neighborhood, and my wife and moved out of the neighborhood, and Larry came with another friend of his and took care of my house of hospitality, St. Stephen's House, for the summer. And then that fall is when he went up to Casa Maria with Mike Cullen and other friends in the Catholic Worker Movement. And that's when he first became closely involved with the Catholic Worker Movement before he went to Brazil. And your excerpt was from his experiences in Recife, Brazil. And I received over the years all of his letters. Mary Lou Pedersen, who was certainly one of his best friends, was also a friend of mine in Chicago at that time.
She provided some of those letters.
In a movement, the Catholic Worker Movement, that was full of people really genuinely practicing the gospel and trying to follow the gospel, I seldom have ever met a person who I thought was closer to the following Jesus and really trying to live the gospel and really trying to take the example of Jesus seriously than Larry. He was also a very generous and warm and loving person.
That's what I've gathered from his writings, and I feel like actually part of the letter that I read tonight dealt with him wanting to stay in Chicago, but the diocese did not allow him to do that. And I'm so thankful that you called in tonight, because I've only spoken to Father Rosebaugh once on the phone, and then he sent me a 28-page letter in 1991 when I was writing a screenplay for the Milwaukee 14, and I just feel like with his untimely death, I wanted to dedicate this show to him because I feel like he's a one-of-a-kind person that completely lived his life out for the gospel, similar to Mike Cullen. And do you have any other personal stories to share about his life?
Well, after that time, I didn't see him very often because he didn't come back to Chicago to visit very often or very much. And then I moved away from Chicago, but at the time when he was up here. And I hope that you're recommending to people his very beautiful autobiography, To Wisdom Through Failure. It's a little bit hard to get a hold of. But
I got it through Jim Forrest and Michael Bob Groff.
Yeah, I reviewed it for the Catholic Worker, and I also wrote an obituary for the Catholic Worker about Larry. And in those articles that are in the Catholic Worker, shortly after Larry's death, the obituary.
I have your obituary right here in front of me. From the National Catholic Report?
I hope on the program you'll do whatever you can to at least read the information on the publisher of that book. I think it's kind of hard to get a bit of it, but it is a beautiful and powerful book about his experiences.
I'll mention it right after you're done speaking, okay? Oh, and I'm so thankful that you called in.
Yeah.
I really, I was never able to meet him in person. He was already serving in Central America, but when I first got into contact with him, but I know that he's done some really wonderful things throughout his life, and I will mention his book and some of the more actions that he took while in Brazil and Guatemala.
And
okay?
El Salvador and Mexico.
He right.
served in all those countries, yeah.
That's true. I do have some of, I did read some of the sections when he was in Mexico as well.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for the call, and I appreciate you calling in.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Ernest, would you like to play the next soundbite?
But as the Book of Acts would have us understand, it sometimes happens that the boat gets rocked and lightning strikes our path. On May 15th, while we were pushing our car to market, two police officers appeared and besieged us with questions. They searched us rudely and seemed a little concerned as to how or whether we made any response. It seems that a couple of missionaries with pants rolled up, shirtless and without shoes, who sleep in the streets, could only be communists, that is, subversives. We were handcuffed and wheeled across the city to a jail designated for thieves. Our arresters, actors in a sad and brutal system, carried out their mission well. Stripped naked, tossed among men on starvation diets in beastly hot rooms, Tom and I received a hurried course in the authoritative mentality. Though held for only 3 days, we met men and women who had been detained in these conditions for 30 to 40 days, untried and denied legal aid. Fed no more than a handful of dry cornmeal at noon and sometimes a small piece of bread at night, we saw large men whose bones were visible at an alarming degree. Creative thoughts about living contemplatively in the midst of the city existence passed through our pores as we sweated what seemed the last drops of water in our bodies. It was our first glimpse at the operation within a police state, calculated, cold, and heartless. Discipline was imposed in each cell by an inmate, hand-picked by the guards. In our cell, authority rested in a young man of 22 or 23, unquestionably a master in the art of instilling fear and compelling submission. As daily routine, we watched him send prisoners flying against the wall, coming down on their heads with blows of extreme force. One morning, he would command a young man to lick crumbs off the floor, while the next he would send thundering kicks to the chest of his fellow inmates.
Thank you for that excerpt, Ernest, and I do want to do a prelude to our next section. I will bring the gentleman back on the line, but I did want to mention in his lifetime he wrote two books. I have the information for the other book, but the one that I'm holding in my hand is To Wisdom Through Failure, A Journey of Compassion, Resistance, and Hope by Larry Rosebaugh with Kateri Hellman Pino. And the foreword is by Ronald Rollheiser of the Oblate Immaculate Mary Immaculate. And it was the copyright is 2006, and it was published by the Ecumenical Program on Central America and the Caribbean, and the acronym for that is EPICA. Now, if you have trouble finding this book, two former members of the Milwaukee 14 have a few copies, Jim Forrest and Bob Groff, and I'll try to get you those if you email me at englishcrush@yahoo.com. I want to read a brief excerpt from one of his books, and at the end of the show I'll give you the other title of his other book. This happened in Brazil when Rosalind Carter was visiting, and Larry Rosebaugh was trying to get national attention to what the Brazilian prisons were like. Once the Archdiocese Human Rights Commission published our denunciation of our arrest and incarceration with all that we saw and experienced those 4 days, the crap hit the fan, so to speak. The military denied nearly everything, even signed a testimony from our doctor that there were signs on our body that we had been struck in various places, and that even after more than a week had passed, the bruises remained. The two arresting policemen said that Tom's Portuguese was even better than theirs, so we must be Brazilians and not citizens of the U.S. When word got out that Rosalind Carter would be speaking with two missionaries who had denounced the authorities for false accusation and arrest and physical and mental abuse while being held in a city jail, the military regime might have wished they had thought twice before having us arrested. I had a personal interview with Mrs. Carter that went well. She appeared very sensitive and an intelligent woman who seemed quite moved after her and Mrs. Mondale, wife of Walter Mondale, had listened to our story and questioned us on almost every aspect of our treatment while incarcerated. When she later met with the official responsible for running the penal system in Recife, Mrs. Carter insisted that no torture of any kind be used in jails and prisons, and if they did, the U.S. government would consider appropriate action. Now, this took part in Larry's early ministry in South and Central America. He also did other actions. One was down by Fort Benning, Georgia, when our government was training El Salvadorans to kill their own people right on American military bases. Him and his friend Linda, they actually disguised themselves as Latino Salvadoran officers and asked the Salvadoran army that was stationed at Fort Benning to pass out flyers. And the Salvadoran army just obeyed the orders because they thought they were officers. And come to find out, they had published pamphlets saying that they refused to serve in the army because it would kill the lives of their brothers and sisters in El Salvador. The army staff from El Salvador passed out the pamphlets without even reading them. And it was actually quite hilarious that they were able to, you know, dress as military officers, go into a base, have army personnel follow their orders, and then create like a subversive action. And as it turns out, Fort Benning was not able to do anything about it because there was a military decree that you could not arrest any civilians on base. So the word got out to the press and it hit the national news that Larry and his friend Linda had posed as these officers and tried to engage the Salvadoran army in refusing to go on, killing missions against humanity in Salvador and participate in training. And I just want to, I am going to want to Ernest's other excerpts, but I just want to read one thing. When we returned from our pamphlet distribution, it was with renewed energy. Roy's creative spirit went to work, and in a short order, we were going off to the army surplus to buy army uniforms with the names of Latinos written on them. And each uniform was that of someone whose rank had been lieutenant or higher. We dressed up as soldiers wearing our uniform and entered the base behind the Salvadoran barracks, and we waited till after 5 p.m. when the soldiers were off duty and at their barracks, and then approached them as officers and ordered them to distribute the literature and break rank, resign from the Salvadoran army, and declare that they refused to participate from this day forward in the killing of their brothers and sisters. It happened as planned. We bought the uniforms, printed the flyers, and dropped them off close to a wooded area. While making our way through the woods, we posted the flyers on trees. We also had in the background the voice of Oscar Romero shouting through the woods, and people got confused. And they also used the same tactic while in Salvador, and they were all arrested after that incident. Now I'm going to the clip. We'd like to have the same caller and another caller come on the line. Ernest, please play the clip.
It is over 2 months since our experiences in jail. Since then, events have moved quickly. The support from our communities was prompt and very encouraging. We were surprised by the opportunity to meet with Rosalind Carter, of which you have heard. After that, we traveled to Rio and San Paulo to report on our experience. There, we were told to continue our work. Return and keep picking up the pieces of what has now opened personally before you. For those who suffer day by day in jail cells, a voice must cry out. Do what you can for those abused and without voice, we were told. Tom, however, was given notice by the government that he must leave the country within 10 days. He was told that he was undesirable and that his services were not needed. Though our work in the streets was temporarily interrupted, a new energy was enkindled within us. We knew that, although we were separated, we would return with new life to the task given to us. On July 14th, Friar Romano Zuffari was issued a document from the President of Brazil ordering him to leave the country, but in a few days. Friar Romano is 67 years old, a Swiss-born priest who has dedicated 15 years of his ministry in Recife to those men and women working in factories. He has published several works that explain and defend the workers' rights. A week ago, 2,000 persons gathered for a vigil in his support. Dom Helder was most eloquent that night in saying clearly that it is the humble and the patient workers, such as Friar Romano, that cause those who seek false priorities to shudder most. I would like to close with this final word. Tom and I were blessed first and foremost with a desire to pray and to put our lives in order. We put into our scheduled times during the day to be quiet and to speak personally and honestly what is in our guts. It is this simple aspect of our lives together for which we now sing a loud alleluia. It is the aspect most important to the survival of the community based on faith, the aspect keeping the Catholic worker alive and striving these many years. Love to all, Larry.
Thank you for that clip, and I'd like to bring a couple of callers back into the show now. Would you like to come back in? Hello?
Yes, sure. I'm still here, Carl. I'm interested to know who the other caller is.
I can't find the resource for Larry's other book. I'm getting a little frustrated.
I didn't
Do you know the name of his other book?
I did not know about another book.
Yeah, I think he wrote it probably like around the late 70s. But, you know, I'll have Ernest post the link after the show. But anyways, did any of those last few sound bites bring up any thoughts for you?
Well, yes. I was a friend of both Roy Bourgeois, who started the School of the Americas protest, and at that time, when Larry and Linda Vendamiglia were down there, there were only three of them, you know, and now every year there's as many as 20,000. So it was built upon very small seed, what they did there at Fort Benning back in the late 80s, very late 80s. But it brought to mind also another action of Larry's at the Atomic Weapons Assembly Plant in Pantex, near Amarillo, Texas, a Pantex plant, where Larry went across into that plant where they assemble nuclear warheads and was sent to prison, federal prison, for a year. And Bishop Leroy Matheson of Amarillo visited him just as a pastor and as a bishop of the diocese in which he was in prison. And Larry's example and Larry's honesty and integrity deeply influenced Bishop Matheson, who subsequently came out and spoke out in his own diocese against the manufacture of an assembly of nuclear weapons in his diocese. That was,
you know,
part
what,
of
he mentioned that in his letter. My producer doesn't want me to do any more reading, but maybe at the beginning of my next show, I'm going to mention that clip. And you described it to a T, that how the bishop came out and supported him. And even though he did probably break the law by trespassing, all he did on that nuclear base was pray. And I don't consider that a crime. He was just trying to draw attention to the situation there. And there was another time in Guatemala that he was isolated in the woods with people who were trying to support the group that our government wasn't supporting. And they played Oscar Romero's voice. They played Oscar Romero's voice in the woods to trick the other people. And it worked, and they went on a rampage, but it ended up being a successful resistance. And that's also in his book, To Wisdom Through Failure. Anyways, I think Ernest might be playing one last clip, and unfortunately the show is ending. But thank you for joining us, and I so much appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
That's all we have tonight, and next week I'm going to mention a few more things about Larry Rosebud at the beginning of this show, because I don't feel like I had a sufficient ending to, you know, to this tribute show. Thank you so much. Thank you, Carl, for joining us.
The preceding program is copyright 2010 Earnest Radio Network. No portion of this broadcast may be reproduced in any form without express written permission from the Earnest Radio Network. Thank you for listening.
You've reached the High Fashion Hotline.
Hi, my family's going to a tailgate, and I want our style to stand out from the crowd.
Just go to Old Navy.
Old Navy?
Yep, Old Navy's got all the latest fall styles. Plus, during Old Navy's colossal sale, you'll save up to 50% off store-wide.
Did you say up to 50% off?
I did, so don't sit on the sidelines. Old Navy has the perfect pants from $19, stylish dresses from $15, and comfy tees for the family from just $6 right now at Old Navy and OldNavy.com.
We're cheering for Old Navy.
High Fashion,
Old Navy. Valid 10-2 to 10-10. Select styles only.
Hi, you've reached the High Fashion Hotline.
Hi, my family's going to a tailgate, and I want our style to stand out from the crowd.
Just go to Old Navy.
Old Navy?
Yep, Old Navy's got all the latest fall styles. Plus, during Old Navy's colossal sale, you'll save up to 50% off store-wide.
Did you say up to 50% off?
I did, so don't sit on the sidelines. Old Navy has the perfect pants from $19, stylish dresses from $15, and comfy tees for the family from just $6 right now at Old Navy and OldNavy.com.
We're cheering for Old Navy.
High Fashion,
Old Navy. Valid 10-2 to 10-10. Select styles only.